Hi everyone. Thank you for choosing to join this session. So the session is on the dynamic future of catastrophe management, the impact of temporal intelligence on general insurance markets. So the presenters for this session is Dr. Joanna Aldridge, who is the Group Head of Catastrophe Research at QBE, and she's passionate about tropical cyclones. The other presenter is Dimitri Grelick, who is the head of accumulation management for OSPAC, also at QBE. So he enjoys running ultra marathons, if you didn't know, including at the Alps. So please join me in welcoming Joanna and Dimitri to the stage.
Thank you much. Thank you so much, Stephen. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for having us today. So what I want to talk about today is a fundamental shift underway in our industry. And this is a move towards temporal intelligence in catastrophe management. This sits at the intersection of catastrophe modelling, climate science, as opposed to climate change science, and insurance decision making. And this has significant implications about how we think about risk, pricing and capital going forward. So let me start with a bit of a thought experiment. Imagine an insurance market where we have a very strong view ahead of time on whether the coming season is going to be relatively benign or quite severe. And based on that, insurers adjust their portfolios, their pricing, and their reinsurance structures as these signals evolve. In this world, insurance pricing could shift from month to month, from week to week, and day to day, a bit like airline ticket pricing. Now this might sound quite extreme, but the elements of this are all coming together to make this feasible. At the centre of this is temporal intelligence. This is a time-bearing, forecast-informed view of risk. Historically, we've treated catastrophe risk as something that's static, largely based on long-term averages and only periodically updated. And this assumption is getting harder to justify. So today, I'd like to explore what happens when we start to relax that assumption and what this may mean for our customers, our insurers, and the broader market. So I'll start with the science, and then I'll hand over to Dimitri to discuss the decision-making impact. Over the last 10 to 15 years, we've witnessed a major transformation in general insurance driven by spatial precision. We've gone from relatively coarse hazard views to location-level pricing with very granular flood maps, detailed bushfire risk layers, and property-level pricing differentiation. This has fundamentally changed how we price risk and created downstream challenges around affordability and regulatory scrutiny. And now we're heading to the next evolution. The question is really, if spatial precision changed the market this much, what might happen as we introduce temporal precision as well? The reason that this is now becoming possible is that the weather and climate forecasting has improved significantly. So this isn't a new concept, but we're now getting the computational powers and models to make this possible. So the weather is highly chaotic and responds to the smallest of perturbations. Okay, accurately modelling the weather requires regular re-nudging back to the observed state. Kind of for a regular weather forecast, we've been looking at kind of 3 to 5 day accuracy. But this is improving, and the key drivers behind this improvement are much better and widespread observational data, particularly for the satellites over the Southern Ocean. Step changes in the computing power available and the use of ensemble numerical weather prediction models. And improvements in data simulation and error correction techniques. We can think about weather forecasting on a range of temporal scales, from the short term, from say 1 to 10 days, where the skill is shown here improving for each of those time scales. But we're also seeing real improvements at longer time frames for sub-seasonal, seasonal, and even out to interannual periods. The atmosphere is a chaotic system and there's still plenty of uncertainty. And the key point here is that the skill is improving and that's improving on time horizons that actually matter for insurance decision making. For Australia, the dominant climate driver that I'll be discussing today is the El Nino Southern Oscillation. It's not our only climate driver, but that's what we're using to illustrate the case here. So most people in this room are very familiar with this concept, but at a high level, Enzo can be thought of as the sloshing back and forth of warm pools of water in the Pacific Ocean. Okay, so the Pacific Ocean is very vast, and the time scales that we're talking about for the warm water to migrate from the deep ocean up to the surface and be driven by the trade winds across the Pacific Ocean actually exceed the annual cycle. And it has a periodicity of 2 to 3 years. As this warm pool migrates, the dominant pressure systems and the trade winds also vary in strength. So, and the basic of the ocean atmospheric system is that these warm pools of water, when they're near the coastline and when winds blow across them, is that they cause rainfall. Okay, so when the warm pools of water near Australia and the wind's blowing onshore, we get a lot of rain. Okay, that's not a La Nina condition. In the El Nino condition, the warm pools of water are closer to South America. We have colder relative water around Australia, and it brings drier conditions. We can measure this via simple indices such as the La Nina 3.4, which observes these pressure shifts across the Pacific. Historically, the seasonal forecasting hasn't been particularly reliable for these climate drivers, especially across this time of year in the autumn predictability barrier. More recent research is starting to show improvements, with the skill extending out for 12 to 16 months. And this is being achieved by applying new modelling techniques combining deep ocean physics with AI techniques, using a greatly expanded set of information rather than just sea surface temperature or pressure dipoles. So we're using a full kind of range of information throughout the water column in multiple places in the ocean. On the top graph, we see the skill in forecasting NINO 3.4 significantly increasing with the recently published XRO model in the black line compared to all other weather models. In the bottom graph, it shows from here we are at the starting point in May that there's a strong emergence in the forecast for an El Nino signal for the coming summer. So if we think about that in insurance context, particularly reinsurance, we're making decisions on a similar timeframe. So certainly here at QBE, our renewal is on the 1-1, and this is the time of year when we're thinking about our next year's reinsurance structure and budgeting. So we're getting to the point where the availability of forecast information is starting to overlap with our decision-making horizons, which raises an interesting question. Are we actually making use of this information? Or are we still effectively assuming a long-term average world? ENSO doesn't shift the average weather conditions. It significantly shifts the return period of the most extreme events with strong spatial correlations across Australia and around the world. So QBE is a global insurer, so this also affects our modelled losses in North America as well. So, for example, bushfire risk is highly correlated to El Nino incidents on the East Coast with correlation coefficients kind of up to 0.6, 0.8, very strong signal. And under La Nina conditions, we get clustering of multiple wet water-related perils. Extreme flood return periods, 5 times more likely on the East Coast than in La Nina, and tropical cyclone landfall is 2 to 3 times more likely on both the East and the West Coast. Let me make this a bit more concrete with some actual loss experience. What this chart is showing is the historical insured losses from the Insurance Council normalised and broken down by peril for bushfire, storm, flood and cyclone against ENSO phases over time. What I'd like to draw your attention to is that when ENSO shifts, both the composition and the magnitude of loss can shift. So when we look at the strong La Nina periods highlighted here, you'll see much higher contributions from storm and flood losses. This is consistent with what we expect in a wetter climate phase. And when we move across the La Nina periods, we see the opposite pattern. Flood reduces and bushfire becomes more prominent. The overall loss signal is lower. So the little inset chart here, it's based on a different loss data set from Moody's, who've let us use this image that they've built out for a longer time period and using a more complete view of the losses that are completely exposure adjusted, shows how the average loss changes relative to neutral conditions across the different ENSO phases. From a portfolio perspective, this matters quite a lot because what looks like a diversified portfolio in a long-term average sense can be highly concentrated under a particular climate phase. In La Nina, we tend to see simultaneous elevation across the wet perils with increased accumulation risk and puts pressure on aggregate covers. In El Niño, the risk shifts towards bushfire, which behaves quite differently in terms of footprint, loss profile, and also risk selection and kind of portfolio management actions. So with that context, let's move on to how the catastrophe models have evolved. So I'm not here to sell you a particular catastrophe model or vendor. We use a multimodal platform at QBE, but the modern catastrophe models becoming available for the Australian market from both the international vendors and our local vendors are starting to reflect the reality of these correlations more explicitly. We're seeing more detailed spatial representation of the secondary perils like hail and flood, customizable and multidimensional vulnerability functions capturing a whole range of rating factors, and more sophisticated and realistic financial modelling at an account and policy level. The key shift that we're focusing on in this talk is how these models are becoming more temporally aware. What these models do is a continuous simulation of the weather, okay? So, and that allows new features such as seasonality, clustering, and a capturing of the antecedent conditions. Traditionally, CAT models have been quite simplistic from a temporal perspective. We've essentially just collapsed that dimension, okay, and reduced the degree of freedom. They assume stationarity, independence between events, and rigid and sometimes very unrealistic event definitions that don't fit with reinsurance contracts. The newer models simulate the continuous weather processes, so instead of treating events as independent, they'll occur as they might naturally occur throughout a season. Once we move to continuous simulation, we capture how events are sequenced, how losses accumulate over the season, how multiple events of different perils may aggregate. These models are conditioned to reflect the current climate rather than a kind of average of the last 40 years of climate, and can capture the joint distributions between perils. This leads us to better management actions, more realistic estimates of aggregate losses, and more meaningful insights into portfolio behaviour over time, which may have real implications for aggregate covers, reinstatements, and hours clauses. I guess the advantage of working at Global Insurer is that we've already rolled out several of these next-generation models for the US and European markets, so we've become more familiar with working them, and it's been quite a transition. This is what the inside or the kind of output file looks like. Since we're actuaries, we'll have a look at the table. There's a sample year loss table here from a continuous simulation. Instead of generating independent events and then stitching them together into a year, the model is simulating a full series of weather and then extracting the events from that. So each row represents a simulated year, and we can see the sequence that the events occurred, the timing of those events, and the losses associated with them. And most importantly, they can be flagged with the climate state. In this case, the ENSO phase. While in a traditional event-based model, the temporal structure is largely lost or approximated after the fact, here it's being explicitly generated. So using this table, we can calculate average losses in the different climate phases. And, of course, a whole heap of different statistics. We can also condition the loss curves on the climate phase here, El Niño versus La Niña, and we can see some quite significant shifts. So this is just illustrative, but what we can see is changes on the order of plus or minus 30% for different return periods. So the 10-year loss, which is important for our capital, is not a single number. It does depend on the climate phase. So if we're using long-term averages to set our capital requirements and inform our reinsurance needs, we're just blending together these climate regimes. Another important shift is around how event definitions line up with how they're defined in the policy terms and reinsurance. So this has always been a problem working in catastrophe natural perils for many, many years that, you know, where is the line between a storm and a flood? But in reality, a single weather system can produce wind damage, hail damage, flash flooding and riverine flooding. The reinsurance contracts are typically worded around a weather event. Here I show a couple of examples that occurred in 2020, the Tri-City hail storm that occurred in January straight after the bushfires and a flood event early in the next month in February. The first was a series of convective fronts that produced hail and extreme flash flooding here in Melbourne. The second was an east coast low, so it brought both wind damage and riverine flooding, especially on the south coast of New South Wales. So the older models have separated quite distinctly the different perils, and this can lead to underestimation of losses and the need for manual adjustments and all sorts of nightmares in loss estimation in event response time. The move towards a more unified weather-based modelling approaches reflect how losses actually occur. At this stage, the proposed model still models storm and wind, storm, which is hail and wind and tornado, separately from flood, being flash flood and riverine flood. But at least they can be related through time based on an underlying kind of weather simulation. So the different models are different vendors are proposing to do this in different ways. Some are just using analogous years, relating back each synthetic year to an actual year in the observed time series, which is kind of like a first approximation. And at a more sophisticated level, some vendors are proposing it's kind of like on a day-by-day level that you'll be able to kind of match up level losses for every kind of every day of a 50,000-year simulation. You'll be able to match up between the peril models, storm losses, flood losses, and other weather losses. In a future iteration, we might start seeing fully integrated weather peril models. So what might this mean in practice? It means that spatial pricing for all perils is becoming widely available to all market participants in Australia. And then, therefore, the competitive differentiation between insurers is shifting from spatial pricing to this temporal view of risk. There's still some real challenges. The signals are noisy. There's uncertainty about how the climate drivers might behave in a warming climate. And importantly, that organisations and regulators might not be able to act as quickly as the risk evolves. But that's what we're here to discuss, discussing through this concept. So with that in mind, let's look at how the decision-making changes. So I'll hand over now to Dimitri to take us through the insurance decision framework.
Okay. Thanks, Gianna. Building on what Gianna just covered, the science, the forecast improvements, and the way models become more temporarily aware, I want to shift the focus slightly to the part that actually determines whether any of this creates value and decision-making. None of this matters until it changes the way what we actually do. And just briefly, as a personal anchor, in about 18 years ago, I presented at a similar seminar on weather perils and insurance. I'm not going to go through that presentation, but what changed since then is not that uncertainty has disappeared, is that we now have a much better ability to observe risk changing through time and much better chance of building decision processes and that react in a controlled way. So if we can see the risk evolving earlier, even probabilistically, are we actually prepared to act on it? Not just monitor it and just report it, but change the behavior while this year is still unfolding. So if we look at the bad year matrix, and what I mean here is not the year has already gone wrong. I mean the year where signals are clearly turning against you. Seasonal outlook deteriorates, early losses begin to emerge, and it becomes apparent that it's not an average season. So you start to feel that the year drifting away and from what you priced and what you planned for. At this point, the options are quite limited, but familiar to most. You can accept the risk, which is basically means staying the course. You rely on the reinsurance budget you've already bought. You rely on diversification, and you keep writing business. You can transfer the risk. You can typically buying additional reinsurance. A comfortable truth is that the moment that you want that protection is often the moment that the market is least accommodating. So the timing key matters. The third option is to reduce risk. You might stop writing in certain areas, impose sub-limits, deductibles, or tighten terms. Or the fourth option is you retain risk differently. You essentially reprice, either broadly or selectively for those risks that are most affected. None of this is new, and the difference in deteriorating season is that decisions become faster, more defensive, and more costly, even if you're slightly late relative to how the risk has already moved. So the temporal intelligence doesn't give you new options, it gives you a chance to move earlier. And typically, once the year has played out, there's a fairly brief period where everyone agrees that the action should have been taken earlier, although usually not by them personally. Now, if we flip to the other side of the matrix, if the insurer knows that the coming season will be favorable in a given region, the same levers exist, but the behavior changes. You can weigh the risk, maintain pricing, and possibly lose share to competitors who choose to compete harder. You can transfer less risk, you buy less reinsurance, or hold less capital. You can increase the risk, expand the appetite, or pursue portfolio growth by lowering pricing or increasing distribution efforts. Or you can retain differently with discounts or rebates. But the response here is not symmetric. If the outlook turns bad, the industry reacts quickly. When the outlook turns good, the industry moves cautiously. The signal you get is still probabilistic, and even a good year can produce a large loss. So with temporal intelligence creates a practical question for leadership. How much of the signal are you actually willing to trust and act on? This becomes as much of a risk appetite and governance question as a modeling question. So this was a conceptual matrix. Now, if we look at the operating model within the insurer, so as Joanna mentioned, traditionally catastrophe risk has been treated as a snapshot. The CAT models are updated monthly or quarterly. Exposure reviews happen quarterly or annually through committees and renewals, and the decision question often collapses to what's our risk, sometimes only fully recognized after the fact. On the right-hand side here is temporal framing, where the dashboards are updated continuously. You get the live inputs that combine the forecast, your exposure change and portfolio mix, and the decision question becomes what's the expected loss today and how is it drifting? So the risk profile that you set at the start of the year is rarely the one that you carry to mid-year or to the end of the year. So rather than treating the catastrophe risk as a static number that we recut periodically, and we start treating it as something closer to the time-evolving system. So it stops being about measuring risk and becomes more about what do you actually do with it. So in this slide, we look at a somewhat practical example with the work journey. We'll look at a scenario which is deliberately simple and normal. Australian insurer that writes a home and motor across New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland. With concentration in hail in bushfire exposed postcodes. They have usual reinsurance structure, like catastrophe excess of loss program. They set the CAT budget at the beginning of the year and include the CAT allowance in their premiums. So as the year emerges, you start with the signals. You see that your growth is above plan, seasonal outlook worsens, early storms, storm claims trend up. So this might sound familiar for some, and then you monitor and see the results impact. Accumulation rising in hail and bushfire postcodes and the probability of exhausting lower layers of reinsurance are increasing. Then you move to actions. And again, these are not groundbreaking actions, but you look to top up reinsurance, potentially add some short-term protection, and or just underwriting growth. The key point here is that none of this is new, and insurers already do all of this now. What changes is timing. timing and discipline. You're acting based on a direction and not certainty. And the goal here is not to achieve perfection. The simple goal is to stay within risk appetite and avoid nasty surprises. This all works only if the actions are pre-agreed. And if every decision requires a fresh debate of what to do, you lose advantage of acting early. And as I mentioned, the goal is fairly deliberately plain. You keep your earnings volatility within tolerance and align actions to your risk appetite. So in simple terms, not to dwell on this, is you get your signals, you monitor the drift, you've got triggers and governed actions to control volatility. So here on this page, I mentioned dynamic reinsurance. So we'll just explore that. In reality, a bit of a reality check on dynamic reinsurance. It sounds like a great idea and fairly simple idea. So if risk increases, is season deteriorating, you buy more protection. If risk decreases, you spend less. In practice, it's actually much harder. First of all, reinsurance is not always available when it's needed. When risk peaks, capacity tightens and terms deteriorate and pricing spikes. By the time you most want your cover, the window may have already been closing. Secondly, it can become expensive. If you're repeatedly purchasing additional cover, it can erode value and you can end up paying a lot more to smooth volatility that's already accepted by the business. And then the governance can be slower than the model. If the decision process is slower than underwriting a risk signal, then you have strategic points. Advantage may be temporary. The signals that you get are not unique, and everyone sees the same. When everyone sees the same signals and hears the same broker advice, they all try to buy protection at once. So differentiator here is not just insight, it's execution speed. So then we move to dynamic pricing, and there's a big question mark whether it's a good idea or whether it's even possible. And the main reason for that is it touches customers directly and interacts with the competitive behavior and regulation. The customers expect stability, and your frequent repricing can damage retention and broker relationships. Competitors may delay responding, which creates pressure to hold the line even if your own signals say risk is rising. Regulatory and conduct expectations constrain how quickly and how visibly prices can move. And then the modeling point remains. The signals that you get from the models are probabilistic, not deterministic, so wrong moves are still possible, and incorrect pricing only creates value when it's balanced against customer, market, and regulatory realities. So if dynamic pricing is even possible, the only way it works if it balances three things: responsiveness, stability, and trust. If you get the balance right, you can improve the outcomes. If not, you just create value without you create volatility without value. So stepping back, the key shift we discussed here is not about better models or better forecasts. It's a shift of how we think about the problem. The catastrophe risk is no longer static input and periodic decisions. It's something that evolves continuously and needs to be managed as it evolves. Seeing the risk earlier doesn't help much if nothing actually changes. So the execution depends on your data, your decision frameworks, governance around those, and access to markets. Dynamic reinsurance in pricing is possible, but it's constrained. So the real challenge is not to see the risk earlier, but to act on it in a way that's timely, controlled, and aligned to how the business operates. So it's not just about who has the best model anymore. It's who can interpret the signal, make decisions, and act on them before the rest of the market reacts. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for that fantastic presentation. So I'm sure there'll be some questions from the audience, so feel free to put in the app or come to the stand and ask a question. Okay, so I'll just maybe kickstart the discussion. So obviously we discussed a few points about what is the possibility with this sort of temporal intelligence for the next stage of catastrophe management. But obviously there are some issues still going to be discussed with whether this would be practical for pricing or reinsurance. But what do you see the actual practical use for within the business side for either insurers or reinsurers?
I think, you know, an immediate practical use is for operations. So to being prepared for the next season of having the claims teams ready to respond to the types of perils that we might be expecting and where they might be occurring, and to be, different insurers have different approaches to this. They might have warehouses of tarpaulins and loss adjusters ready to fly out so that they can be prepared. So that's an operational kind of level to be ready to respond. I think another lever, maybe if we're not ready to actually kind of shift the numbers and the view of risk itself, is our kind of level of appetite of comfort around that view of risk. So when you're setting the catastrophe allowance, maybe there is a bit of buffer or kind of a thought of like what is the unmodeled risk in there, and you might be able to adjust that kind of level of comfort based on what kind of phase you think the climate might be in.
Just that with budgeting and using the catastrophe models, given I don't think the companies are prepared to adjust their budgets depending on what the models are predicting and what Joanna tells them the next season is going to look like. You still look at the long-term averages. Don't react as quickly as the climate's changing or being predicted.
Okay, so there is a question here. So I just read it out. So does the increased temporal granularity comes from interpolations between the previous projections, or is it based on new approaches? Are there differences when comparing with projections at greater temporal granularity?
So there's a difference between a projection and a forecast. So when we're projecting climate change trends, that's under certain warming scenarios and usually for quite long into the future. So what we're discussing here is forecasts. And yes, there are new methods emerging in weather forecasting, both in numerical weather prediction and the implementation of AI. The AI is usually, and machine learning is in between layers of the weather prediction. And that is showing the improvement in the skill of the weather forecast that I showed. So, that's what's giving kind of... I wouldn't say it's a temporal granularity, like you're getting improvement in the 3-day forecast over the 5-day forecast, but it's just a general improvement in the trend and skill in the weather forecasting on different temporal time scales.
Okay, thank you very much for the great talk. I mean, the increase in forecast ability is really exciting. I just want to touch on one thing both of you actually mentioned, right? The fact that the forecast, it's still uncertain, it's not sure, and that there is an issue around how, if you try to use this, there's an execution speed issue. Now, coming at it, I mean, it's coming, these techniques are coming through the new CAT model vendors, but you heavily rely on one or two for those cases, right? So when you had time to think about it and modify it to your case, you know, not with such temporal stress, I mean, you can do auto modification. But if everyone's trying to do it very quickly, all reliant on the same model vendor, say, do you see, I mean, I know you touched this, do you see much more risks with that, if you try to actually do that?
I'll start with the models and head over to Dimitri. So just touch on the models. It's the CAT model vendors of themselves aren't kind of giving a forecast. What they're giving is a tool that will allow you from a forecast that's, say, issued by the Bureau or other weather forecast sources, that if you are seeing an emergence of, let's say, like in the El Nino state this summer, that allows you to categorise those losses and produce the statistics relevant to that climate state. So you don't have to believe their categorization of those losses either. They can be kind of fine-tuned and kind of given your own company kind of view of risk over that as well, which might be relevant in if you have quite strong spatial concentrations. I don't think so. In terms of concentration of model risk, no, I don't think so, because the market's already concentrated in terms of model risk. We're already using, like saying, there's about three or four main vendors in Australia for catastrophe risk at the moment.
I'm not sure if I want to add anything else.
Yeah.
Dave, again, great presentation. Thank you for sharing. And it's great to have like deep experts in the field presenting. So just, Joanna, in your presentation, you presented weather forecasts and how well they've done over time. Is there similar studies on these El Nino, La Nina cycles, how well they have been predicted or projected as science has improved over time?
I don't have a slide there on particular upcoming cycles. The reason that it hasn't is that, you know, we only get one realisation of the climate. So even a forecast that was 3 or 5 years ago predicting what El Nino or El Nino would be in the current season, that's the only kind of data point we have of kind of like 3 or 5 data points that might be using the weather tools that we have available to us right now. So the only way we can really investigate that is through kind of ensemble-based modelling. And I just sponsor a few research projects on that where we can look at multiple kind of outcomes of the climate in particular years. One with the National Climate and Atmospheric Laboratory in Colorado, we're looking at US hail risk and how that and the interannual variability in that. And another one with RIAS, we're looking at North Atlantic hurricane, kind of just what is the kind of probability space for North Atlantic hurricane over the last 40 years, kind of beyond what just the 40 years that we've actually observed.
Hey, I note that a key aspect of insurance is to be in the public interest. Is switching to a temporal, very short-term view in a pricing sense going to be against the public interest in that it's going to significantly increase prices and reduce insurance supply when it's most needed?
That's a good point, and it depends how you react to the models, and
I think, you know, like if you're a listed insurer, we're acting in the interest of our shareholders and trying to maximise profit, and this is a way that can be done. So that's why we've opened a question here about discussing what the implications of that might be. Because we did have the similar discussions when the insurers were all rolling out flood insurance 15 years ago. And nothing is really going to stop the company pursuing a competitive advantage, right? And we've ended up in a state where flood is very finely risked to the property level or the centroid level of that property within its block. And it's hard to reverse that kind of industry trend once the competitive advantages start emerging.
The other point is... whether you can use that for risk mitigation, given you know what's happening, whether you can work for the public good and then publish the flood maps and encourage governments to mitigate risk.
Yep. So, yeah, I do agree that in to consider. Oh, yeah. Sure. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. I'm just thinking about how one would apply the temporal signals in practice, and I'm thinking particularly of the current El Nino signals, which, if you take them at face value, are going to produce an all-time record El Nino. So the question is, would you take it at face value? That signal presumably must come with some kind of confidence interval around it. And so a Bayesian response to that would be to assign a credibility to the signal, credibility being lower according to higher confidence intervals, larger confidence intervals. And so that would lead you to dampen your response to signals of that sort. Is this what happens in practice?
The graph on the screen shows, roughly a confidence interval around forecast. We've got a range of spread of different model outcomes for El Nino for the current season. They're all positive. So the El Nino's looks very, very likely, but there is a range in the magnitude and degree of that El Nino. That this signal, if you this goes back to the previous question, like how has that improved over time? It has improved quite a lot. The previous spread in the models would have had ones that were both positive and negative at this time of year. So in terms of, I'm here to do the catastrophe modelling and deliver the message, and it's up to the people in the business who set the plan and buy the reinsurance to make what they can of that. But the uncertainty around this as well is also, as you said, an important part in that decision making.
I'm not sure that not maybe somebody can correct me, but insurers react to this prediction now, whether they just stick to their guns and just set the long term average, no matter what the next season is being predicted to be, I would struggle delivering the message at QBE, but.
Previously, I've worked at Munich Re, and they sponsored this type of research, and they actively do use this at Munich Re to understand their risk. Because when you get into the reinsurance and the very high layers, this signal and the loss signal are much more stronger as well.
Great. Thank you.
Hi. I've got one question. So just Google at the moment. We're currently not in El Nino, El La Nina. So just on the paper you've got there, how well are we able to capture where these transitionary phases in the modelling process? Like, is it almost like you pick a binary state, one or two, in your forecast?
Yeah, I didn't really touch it. There is a neutral phase as well. It's just boring. So you're right. Currently, right now in this autumn period of the year, we're in a neutral phase, and a neutral phase happens kind of like roughly like 40% of the time. It brings its own kind of particular loss pattern as well. We tend to see a lot more, maybe more hailstorms in a neutral phase. So it does depend on the risk profile of the company itself whether the neutral phase is kind of relevant as well. So it's not as simple as this, and it's not binary. There are phases, and then also the strength of the El Nino or La Nina is important. So you could kind of classify it into five states: neutral, weak, two weak wet or dry phases, or in a strong wet or dry phase.
So in some sense, where we're in these transitionary phases, I guess, how would we sort of model these outcomes given, like, how much weight would you put in those middle sort of phases?
Like, we're in...
Yeah.
Oh, well, it would depend on the model forecast of what the current coming season might look like, because the forecast might be for a neutral season.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I suppose a couple of comments. I mean, it's great work. But I think the biggest challenge you've got is the length of time you've got to forecast, and obviously there's a great increasing funnel of doubt. The practicality of reflecting some of this in things like pricing, you've got to remember we're writing 12-month policies. I'm sure your El Niño or La Niña forecasts are not 2-year, 3-year sort of, or 18-month sort of forecasts. So it does become a challenge, but it is something you do need to consider. You mentioned being able to potentially consider some short-term reinsurance. Yes, I mean, that's something you could consider. But the other thing, of course, I think that Joanna did mention was it actually is very useful in terms of preparing the claims teams for the upcoming season. So if you know you're heading towards a La Niña, then you've got to keep in mind that you're going to need potential resources, particularly claims resources, if you're going to have greater risk of large events. So probably not really a question, more a comment on how that the practically that could possibly be useful, or it is useful.
All right, I think we've run out of time, but please feel free to reach out to us if you have any more questions. Can we again thank both of the speakers for today's presentation?